This is Audible.
Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from the Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled Law School for Everyone, Constitutional Law. Your lecturer is Eric Berger. Mr. Berger is a professor of law at the University of Nebraska College of Law. He has been voted Professor of the Year 5 times. And he is recipient of the College of Law Distinguished Teaching Award. Lecture 1, Origins and Functions of the Constitution.
In 2015, a case came before the United States Supreme Court involving a same-sex male couple that had been living in the state of Ohio. The couple, John Arthur and James Obergefell, had gotten married in Maryland, and soon after that, Arthur had died. Ohio law defined marriage as the union of one man and one woman, and the state refused to recognize the marriage on Arthur's death certificate. Obergefell sued, and the key question that confronted the Supreme Court was whether a state's decision to prohibit same-sex marriage violated the U.S. Constitution. Underlying that question, however, were more fundamental ones that our nation has struggled to address since its earliest days. How should the Constitution be interpreted? Who decides its meaning? And what, if anything, does the Constitution have to say about issues the framers didn't directly address, and in many cases couldn't have possibly anticipated? Mr. Obergefell contended that Ohio's same-sex marriage prohibition violated same-sex couples' fundamental right to marry and their equal protection right under the 14th Amendment to be treated the same as opposite-sex couples. Indeed, he argued that the very purpose of Ohio's marriage ban was to impose inequality and stigma on same-sex couples. Ohio responded that the Constitution leaves this policy decision with the states and their voters. If the people of Ohio want to adopt same-sex marriage, the state argued, that's their prerogative. But the Constitution says nothing about same-sex marriage and certainly does not dictate marriage policy to the states. In a landmark 5-4 decision called Obergefell v. Hodges, the court sided with Mr. Obergefell and implicitly same-sex couples across the nation. It reasoned that a person's choice about whether and whom to marry is among the most personal and important decisions of a person's life, finding that the denial of the right to that decision would violate both the Equal Protection and Due Process clauses of the 14th Amendment. The court held that the state could not constitutionally deny same-sex couples the right to marry if they wish. In one of 4 dissenting opinions, Chief Justice John Roberts acknowledged the appeal of the majority's arguments from a policy standpoint, but emphasized that the court is not a legislature. Judges, therefore, should not decide cases based on what they think is good policy, but rather based on the Constitution. In his view, the Constitution, quote, had nothing to do with the majority's decision. How do you feel about the court's decision? We'll take up the case in more detail in a later lecture, but as you might imagine, people on both sides feel very strongly about it. The intensity of this disagreement is characteristic of disputes over constitutional issues generally, from abortion to affirmative action, to the scope of federal power, to to presidential power in times of war, and more. In fact, the great policy debates and culture wars of our time are often waged as battles over constitutional meaning. Why? Because the Constitution is the blueprint for American government, setting the rules by which politics operate. The stakes are therefore very high. Though most Americans throughout our history have never actually read it, we've been arguing about the Constitution since it was written. As of this taping, there are movements underway to change the Constitution in fundamental ways. Their proponents, who include both conservatives and liberals, argue that a new constitutional convention should be held to fix a variety of perceived problems in the ways our government and society function. Is that a good idea? To answer that question properly, and to understand American government, politics, and law, we must understand how the Constitution works, how it has been interpreted, and why we have the document in the first place. So that's what we're going to explore in this course, starting with the Constitution's origins in the 18th century. In the year 1786, the United States was in crisis. The young country had won its independence from Great Britain with the end of the Revolutionary War in 1783, but its problems were far from over. The states, which had been allied with each other in the war against England, now were becoming bitter rivals. They quarreled over a variety of important issues. For example, the states disagreed about the proper rules for commerce between their borders. States enacted laws that aided their own citizens, but they disadvantaged other states and citizens from those states when conducting trade or business. States with big ports, for instance, could not resist taxing goods from nearby states. Nearby states still had to use the ports to sell the goods, but they tried to retaliate in other ways. Matters began to come to a head when negotiations between Maryland and Virginia over fishing and trading rights on the Potomac River grew into an open invitation to all the states to meet at Annapolis, Maryland's capital, in 1786. As it happened, delegates from only five states showed up, and they concluded that they couldn't accomplish much without more states represented. So they put out a call for a broader meeting the next year in Philadelphia. That meeting would become the Constitutional Convention of 1787. By the time the delegates met in Philadelphia, it was clear that the Articles of Confederation, which had taken effect in 1781, were insufficient to govern the young country. In a nutshell, the Articles of Confederation provided for only a very weak central government, which was unable to manage either disputes between the states or the various external and internal threats the nation faced. For example, under the Articles, the Confederation Congress could not impose taxes, and national defense and prosperity had suffered as a result. Lacking the money for a decent army or navy, America found itself in the mid-1780s at the mercy of foreign pirates marauding on the high seas. This made international trade more difficult. Closely related to the issue of taxes was the issue of debt. In part because of its inability to tax, the Confederation Congress had taken out large amounts of debt to finance the Revolutionary War. Still lacking a source of revenue, America was unable to pay back its loans. This seriously threatened the nation. If America developed the reputation as a country that did not repay its debts, it would find it very difficult to borrow money in the future. And borrowed money was vital to a growing economy. Moreover, foreign countries to which America owed money might go so far as to treat non-payment of debts as grounds for war, and the American continent was still a tempting target for European empires searching for new lands to conquer. America faced several other external challenges to the national welfare in the wake of the Revolutionary War. American merchants were eager to restore pre-war patterns, the bulk of which included trade with England itself and English colonies in the Caribbean. But Britain, still angry at the colonies, promptly closed its harbors to American ships, both on the British Isles and in the Caribbean. Meanwhile, British ships sailed into American harbors, bringing goods that had been missed during the war. Many countries would have imposed large taxes on British ships or simply closed their ports in response. But the Confederation Congress lacked both the power to tax and to regulate either interstate or foreign commerce. And the states, of course, were not coordinated enough to issue a set of restrictions themselves. All this made it impossible for American ambassador to England, John Adams, to negotiate a satisfactory commercial treaty with England. England already had what it wanted, so why negotiate? Another foreign relations issue to confront America after the war concerned the peace treaty itself. After war had broken out, many states had confiscated property owned by British subjects or loyalists. The Treaty of Paris of 1783 required the Confederation Congress to recommend that the states permit British subjects and loyalists to sue for the recovery of confiscated property. In the meantime, however, the state governments that had confiscated the property often had sold it to third parties, placing the weak Confederation Congress in the awkward position of guaranteeing what it lacked the constitutional power to deliver. The British used the non-compliance with the treaty as a pretext for retaining their forts in upstate New York and Michigan, which they also were supposed to abandon under the terms of the treaty. This further jeopardized the plans for Americans to move westward, in part because the British encouraged Native American tribes to resist American encroachments on their land. Still another foreign relations problem involved the territorial integrity of the young country. Spain controlled New Orleans in the 1780s, and in 1784, it closed the city and the lower part of the Mississippi River to American navigation. This made life extremely hard for settlers and farmers living west of the Appalachian Mountains. Previously, those settlers had shipped their produce and goods down the Mississippi River and into the Gulf of Mexico, and that way kept up trade relations with the rest of the American states on the East Coast. This was easier than traversing the rugged mountains with their goods. The Spanish action isolated those settlers, and Spain apparently hoped to bring them under Spanish control, thereby helping solidify Spanish control of the region, discouraging further migration west of the Appalachians, and protecting Spanish silver mines in Mexico. The young United States, lacking military and diplomatic clout, could do little in response. On top of all of this was internal chaos. The most famous example is Shays Rebellion in western Massachusetts. Shays Rebellion grew out of an economic depression Massachusetts suffered in the mid-1780s, as it was still trying to pay off its sizable wartime debt. The state government, located 125 miles away in Boston, was imposing heavy taxes on farmers in western Massachusetts to try to pay off its creditors, most of whom lived in the Boston area. Times were already tough for the farmers, some of whom had spent time in debtor's prison. Correctly or not, they thought that the courts tended to side with the wealthier creditors. When the farmers refused to pay the new taxes, the state took them to court, and the courts ordered their farms seized. Infuriated, the farmers organized their own militia of 2,000 troops. Led by Daniel Shays, some of these rebels surrounded courts around western Massachusetts so that the courts couldn't open and order more farms seized. The state militia that was called out to stop the rebels refused to do so, and in some instances even joined them. The rebels' next goal was the First National Armory in Springfield, which held cannons, muskets, and gunpowder. The rebels marched through one of Massachusetts's worst winters and managed to cut off the roads to the arsenal on three sides. They pledged to kill any prisoners they captured. As this internal crisis intensified, the Confederation Congress met in New York to authorize the recruitment of federal troops to restore order in Massachusetts. The states, however, refused to pay for federal troops. This only deepened the problem. The central government had proven unable to suppress what was becoming a major domestic uprising. Realizing they would receive no help from either their own state militia or Congress, Boston's wealthiest men pooled their money and underwrote a state force of 4,000 men. These fighters joined with state forces and defeated the Shays rebels after pursuing them through the snow for a week. Shays rebellion was over, but it still had enormous political impact. About a decade after the Declaration of Independence, Americans were fighting against and killing other Americans. It was not just strangers fighting each other, but neighbors fighting neighbors. And government had been unable to cool tensions beforehand or suppress the uprising once it arose, even in Massachusetts, which supposedly had one of the best state constitutions. Something had gone terribly wrong, and Americans all over the country took notice. Their governments had failed them. It was against this backdrop of multiple and interrelated governmental failures that the delegates met in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787. The states had sent their representatives to revise the Articles of Confederation, but many of the delegates believed that the Articles were beyond repair and that an entirely new charter of government was necessary. They therefore began debating the contents of a new constitution, even though such a departure from their initial mandate was a lawless action. From the start, it became apparent that the delegates could not agree on much. Two disagreements dominated the convention. The first involved the question of how states would be represented in Congress. Many delegates assumed that states would have proportionate representation in the House of Representatives, meaning that states with larger populations would get more representatives than states with smaller ones. But what about the Senate? Some delegates, such as James Madison, believed the Senate too should have proportionate representation. Others, especially from smaller states, believed that each state should have the same number of representatives in the Senate. As you surely know, the Constitution ultimately provided that each state would get two senators, but the delegates would debate the issue over and over again. Second was the question of slavery. Some Southern delegates insisted that the Constitution provide ample protection for slavery, and they got their way. The Constitution that emerged from the convention prohibited Congress from abolishing the slave trade for 20 years. It stipulated that runaway slaves be returned to their owners, even if they had managed to flee to a state without slavery. And perhaps most notoriously, it provided that each slave be counted as 3/5 of a person for purposes of a state's representation in the House of Representatives. As a result, states with large slave populations got disproportionately large representation in the House and through the Electoral College system in presidential elections as well. In other words, though slaves did not enjoy the right to vote, their presence meant that white citizens in slave states who did enjoy the right to vote got increased representation in the federal government. This arrangement helped the Southern states further entrench slavery in the decades to come. It was not until the 13th Amendment abolished slavery in 1865, at the end of a brutal and long civil war, that the Constitution's pro-slavery provisions would be undone. It's interesting to note that the framers didn't spend a lot of time debating many of the issues we care about most today. For instance, they said very little about individual rights. They said very little about the power of the federal courts to review the constitutionality of governmental action. They also didn't come to much agreement on the power of the U.S. president. Moreover, they rarely reached consensus on the issues they did debate. As a result, the final document was very much a compromise that most delegates agreed was imperfect. Madison himself, sometimes called the father of the Constitution, was disappointed by several features of the Constitution, including the convention's decision not to give the federal government a veto power over state governments. By its own terms, the Constitution could only take effect if 9 of the 13 states ratified it. During the ratification debates that followed throughout the country, it became clear that there was widespread disagreement, not just about whether to adopt the new Constitution, but also about what it meant. These debates foreshadowed centuries of disagreement to come. While the Constitution left many important issues unresolved, it was clearly designed to serve some primary purposes. We might disagree about how it serves those purposes, but it's worth identifying what those purposes were. First and foremost, the Constitution establishes a national government and allocates power among the branches of that government. Article 1 creates Congress and confers upon it enumerated legislative powers. This Congress is bicameral, meaning it contains two houses. Article 1 sets the qualifications for each House's members and also generally defines the procedures for enacting laws. Article 2 creates the presidency and gives it the executive power. It defines the office, the qualifications of the occupant, the method of elections, and the powers of the presidency, though it's very vague as to the scope of executive power. Article 3 creates the U.S. Supreme Court and authorizes Congress to create lower federal courts. It also specifies the categories of cases over which the federal court shall have jurisdiction. Note that the creation of a national government was a big deal in 1787. As we've already seen, America's national government, under the Articles of Confederation, had very limited powers and even lacked a chief executive and a federal judiciary. While the crises of the 1780s convinced many Americans that they needed a stronger central government than the Articles had provided for, the shift from the very weak decentralized government under the Articles to the stronger national government under the Constitution signaled a major shift in American political life. It's therefore no mystery why the Constitution did not vest federal power all in one place. Although the framers realized that the Articles of Confederation had gone too far in decentralizing power, they also remembered English colonial rule well enough to view the centralization of power as a means to tyranny. To the framers, King George III of England had tyrannized the colonies, and he had been able to do so in part because no other branch of government possessed sufficient power to balance the king's vast authority.
Although Parliament behaved tyrannically too.
Partially as a reaction to their experience under English rule, the framers created a constitutional system in which multiple branches must act to accomplish any result. For example, to enact a law, both houses of Congress must pass a bill and the president must sign it, unless the legislature is able to override an executive veto by a supermajority, which is difficult and doesn't happen very often. And if Congress enacts a criminal law, enforcement requires prosecution by the executive branch and conviction within the judiciary. A second thing the Constitution does is sketch the relationship between the federal and state governments. Ours is a federalist system, meaning that we have two kinds of governments, national and state, with jurisdiction over the same territory. There was already a federalist system in place under the Articles of Confederation, of course, but power resided almost entirely within the states. The framers recognized that there were certain governmental functions that could be performed much better by one central government rather than multiple different states. In particular, they thought a national government was necessary for defending the country, for relations with other countries, for a national currency, and for the regulation of national commerce. But the framers still left much power with the states themselves. Where in the Constitution can we see the balance the framers actually struck between national and state power? Well, Article 1 grants Congress certain enumerated powers. It says, quote, "All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States." Thus, if the Constitution does not grant Congress a specific power, Congress lacks that power. Of course, subsequent amendments to the Constitution added to Congress's power, most notably the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which were adopted between 1865 and 1870 after the Civil War, vested more power in the national government to enforce new rights created by those amendments. Thus, these Reconstruction Amendments, as they're known, altered the original balance between the state governments and the national government. But even taking these changes into consideration, the Constitution defines Congress's powers rather than leaving them open-ended. Also, the 10th Amendment stipulates that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited to the states are reserved to the states or to the people. So if we read these two principles together, we get the rule that congressional action is only valid if the Constitution authorizes it, and that state action is valid unless it's prohibited. In other words, under our constitutional system, federal action is presumptively invalid and state action is presumptively valid. However, It's also worth noting that once federal laws are properly enacted, Article 6 of the Constitution makes clear that those laws are the supreme law of the land and trump any state laws to the contrary. So the federal government has more limitations on the kinds of laws it's allowed to make than do state governments. But the Supremacy Clause stipulates that when in conflict, valid federal law is supreme over otherwise valid state law. A third major goal of the Constitution is to protect individual rights. As I mentioned earlier, the original Constitution said very little about individual rights. Most of the important liberties that many Americans consider core constitutional rights, free speech, free exercise of religion, freedom from unreasonable search and seizures, and so on, they were added to the Constitution as the Bill of Rights, the Constitution's first 10 amendments, which were ratified in 1791. That's not to say that the Constitution completely ignored individual rights before the Bill of Rights, but it didn't protect much. This absence of individually protected rights in the Constitution of 1787 may seem surprising, but some framers believe that the protection of specific rights was unnecessary because the very structure of government protected rights. In other words, they understood that the checks and balances they were building into government, separation of powers, bicameralism, federalism, those existed to protect individual rights from the excesses of government. Moreover, these Americans were quick to point out that their system of government was decidedly different from that of England. England had its Magna Carta from 1215 and its Bill of Rights from 1689, and both those protected some individual rights.
But in England, Parliament was sovereign, so the people needed explicit protection from the sovereign, from the country's governing powers. But as the founding generation came to see it, in the United States, sovereignty resided not in the government, but in the people themselves. The people sent their representatives to government, but in so doing, they did not cede sovereignty to the government. Consequently, a Bill of Rights was seen by many as irrelevant. Of course, ultimately, a Bill of Rights was added to the Constitution, in large part because many states that ratified the Constitution did so on the condition that a Bill of Rights be added. In fact, the Bill of Rights was really offered in part as a political compromise to appease anti-federalists who were fighting against ratification in many states and wanted additional assurances that government would not become tyrannical. Some members of the founding generation also recognized the potential for tyranny of the majority and saw the Bill of Rights as an additional safeguard against that tyranny. Bear in mind, however, that the Bill of Rights of 1791 was much more limited in scope than the provisions that so pervade our constitutional consciousness today. Indeed, it originally only applied to the federal government, meaning that the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights did not protect against state governmental infringement of these rights. Many states had their own Bill of Rights and their own state constitutions, but most of the rights in the Bill of Rights were much later applied to the states through the 1868 14th Amendment. But in many cases, that did not occur until well into the 20th century. One final note about individual rights. Almost all constitutional rights protect people from governmental action, not private conduct. The only exception is the 13th Amendment, which prohibits slavery, including, of course, slaveholding by private individuals. Otherwise, however, constitutional rights only involve the relationship between the government and individuals, not the relationship between individuals. Individuals are protected from each other by private laws, such as tort law and contract law, but government action is required for the Constitution to apply. Of course, the Constitution empowers government to pass certain laws that apply to private conduct, but for the most part, the Constitution does not constrain private conduct by its own force. So those are the major things the Constitution does. As you can see, it's not so hard to summarize the Constitution's primary purposes in broad strokes, but that doesn't mean it's easy to figure out what outcomes the Constitution requires in particular cases. For better or worse, the Constitution often doesn't speak for itself. Sometimes, as in the case of Obergefell v. Hodges that we considered earlier, issues arise that are not directly addressed by any constitutional provision. In other cases, the Constitution's broad, open-ended language raises questions as to when they should apply. What does due process mean? Cruel and unusual punishment? Equal protection? Privileges and immunities? Even when the Constitution is written in absolute terms, most people agree that, at least with regards to individual rights, it usually does not function in absolutes. Circumstances matter. The First Amendment, for example, is written in absolute terms and prohibits Congress from making any law impinging the freedom of speech. But Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes famously said that falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic is not protected. And most people would agree that the right to free speech, though crucial in a free society, must have certain limitations. Lawyers and judges are therefore left to argue about how best to interpret the Constitution. Historically, they have drawn on a variety of sources, including the Constitution's text and structure, judicial precedent, original understandings, past governmental practices, practical concerns, moral concerns, and more. As you might expect, lawyers and judges frequently disagree with each other about not just how to decide particular constitutional cases, but also about interpretive methodologies. It's probably not surprising, then, that the U.S. Supreme Court decides a lot of high-profile constitutional cases, like the same-sex marriage case, by a 5-4 vote. The open-ended nature of the Constitution's language can make constitutional law maddeningly uncertain. I think you'll find, though, once you sweep away all the nuances and complexities, it usually boils down to a single question. Who decides? Who decides the meaning of the Constitution and the content of governmental policy? The federal or the state government? The courts or the legislature or the executive branch? The people themselves? And if so, how do we figure out what they think? Some combination? If it's a combination, who is the final word when there's a disagreement? Over the next 11 lectures, we will examine numerous constitutional cases and doctrines. We'll dig into the weeds of some famous decisions and legal reasoning. As we do so, I suggest you keep in mind this question of who decides. Because at the end of the day, constitutional law is usually not about which policy is wisest or which values are most American or morally acceptable. No, constitutional law is about power, and specifically where power resides in American government and whether a particular governmental entity has the authority to do what it's trying to do. It is similarly about whether and when courts have the proper authority to tell a governmental entity that it may not do what it's trying to do. And it is about how judges, other public officials, and ordinary citizens should think about and frame these questions. Unpredictable or elusive as the answers may sometimes be, they matter enormously because they govern our individual liberty, our governmental structure, and the character and future of our nation.
The legal information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing legal advice. You should contact an attorney to obtain advice with respect to any particular legal issue or problem. Lecture 2, The Marshall Court and the Constitution.
We are used to thinking of the U.S. Supreme Court as the ultimate arbiter of constitutional questions. But why is that? Why isn't it the President or Congress who decides? The Constitution is silent on this point, but as I've mentioned, the matter of who decides is at the core of most issues in constitutional law. To understand the Court's role in constitutional decision-making, we need to go back to the early decades of the Republic and examine a pair of the Court's most famous early opinions. Marbury v. Madison, decided in 1803, and McCulloch v. Maryland, decided in 1819. Interestingly, both opinions were written by the famous Chief Justice John Marshall, yet they offer significantly different, even conflicting visions of the Court's role. As a side note, many courses in constitutional law begin as we do, with the judiciary, because for better or worse, many of the most contentious constitutional issues of our time end up in the courts. In our next lecture, we'll consider the executive power. We'll then turn to congressional power third, because many of the issues that we'll discuss regarding Congress are also very relevant to questions that we'll take up immediately after that. We'll begin our consideration of the Supreme Court's role with Marbury v. Madison. This case grew out of the presidential election of 1800, one of the most unusual and bitter in American history. The election pitted the incumbent Federalist John Adams against the Republican Thomas Jefferson. Adams favored a stronger central government. Jefferson favored a smaller, decentralized government. Turns out the founders debated many of the same issues we do today. Jefferson won the election, but the lag time between election and inauguration was longer in those days than it is now. So Jefferson would not take office until March 1801. In the remaining weeks of his presidency, President Adams and his fellow Federalists worked to consolidate the Federalist control of the federal court system. Among other things, they engineered Congress's passage of the Organic Act for the District of Columbia, which created 42 justices of the peace. With just 2 days to go in his term, Adams collected names to fill the new positions, and the next day the Federalist-leaning Senate confirmed them all. President Adams stayed up late his final night in office signing the commissions. Aides transferred them to the acting Secretary of State, John Marshall, who affixed the Great Seal on them as a sign of their finality. Most of the commissions were then hastily delivered to their intended recipients. But there weren't enough aides on hand to distribute them all, and four went undelivered. One of these undelivered commissions was for a 5-year term for William Marbury. The next day, March 4th, 1801, Thomas Jefferson was sworn in as president, and he ordered his Secretary of State, James Madison, not to deliver the remaining commissions. Of course, to Jefferson and the other Republicans, these last-minute Justice of the Peace appointments, like recent judicial appointments by Adams, were just another example of the Federalists defying the popular will to keep control of the government. Jefferson felt that such measures were entirely inappropriate, so he felt perfectly justified in not delivering the commissions. William Marbury, however, believed he had a legal right to his commission, and in December 1801, he filed suit to obtain it. Marbury's suit had a couple of procedural quirks that are worth highlighting, because they're important in understanding the case. First, Marbury's suit asked the court for a writ of mandamus. A writ is a written order from a court requiring a particular remedy. A writ of mandamus is an order from a court to an executive official ordering that official to properly carry out his or her duties or to correct an abuse of discretion. Second, Marbury took the unusual step of filing his case directly in the U.S. Supreme Court. Most cases originate in lower courts and never make it to the Supreme Court. If they do, they mostly get there on appeal. Why would Marbury file into the Supreme Court first? One answer might be that the Chief Justice of the court was John Marshall, the very same person who, as acting Secretary of State, had affixed the seal on Marbury's commission in the waning hours of the Adams administration. Marshall was a committed Federalist, and Marbury may have thought that Marshall would ensure him favorable treatment. Of course, Marshall's dual role as acting Secretary of State and Chief Justice posed both ethical and constitutional questions. It very likely violated the principle of separation of powers for the same person to serve simultaneously as a president's cabinet member and an Article III judge. If Chief Justice Marshall recognized these problems, he didn't acknowledge them. Nevertheless, Marbury v. Madison put Marshall in a difficult position. As a diehard Federalist, he not only believed that Marbury and Adams' other appointees deserved their commissions, he also believed that Jefferson was attacking the federal judiciary generally. But the judiciary in the early 19th century didn't have the clout it enjoys today, and Marshall worried that a decision in Marbury's favor would ultimately weaken the court. If the court were to order Secretary of State Madison to deliver Marbury his commission, Madison could simply ignore it. Such an outcome would highlight the judiciary's weakness. Even worse, the administration might ignore Marshall and try to impeach him, and possibly the other justices. So Chief Justice Marshall's challenge was to find a way to defend and even build the judiciary's institutional legitimacy without provoking the executive to attack it. What could he do? Writing for the court, Chief Justice Marshall crafted a supremely strategic opinion that framed the case as turning on three key questions. First, Marshall asked if Marbury had a right to the commission he requested. The answer, an emphatic yes. When the president signs a commission and the Secretary of State seals it, he asserted, the commission becomes official. As a result, William Marbury had a legal right to the job that the Jefferson administration was denying him. Now, the law isn't actually clear that a signed and sealed commission is official before it's delivered, nor is it clear that a new president may not choose his own justices of the peace, but Chief Justice Marshall simply ignored these potential complications. Having answered his first question, Marshall then turned to his second. If Marbury has a right to the commission, and that right has been violated, do the laws of his country afford him a remedy? Once again, the Chief Justice's answer was a resounding yes. Here, Marshall drew a distinction that is crucial for thinking about court's authority over executive officials more generally. When executive officials, like the Secretary of State, are performing a discretionary function, he argued, the courts are powerless to tell those officials what to do. Sometimes, however, an official doesn't have discretion, but rather a duty to perform certain acts. In such cases, as Marshall put it, an official cannot at his discretion sport away the vested right of others. And this, of course, was what Chief Justice Marshall thought Secretary of State James Madison was doing. In the court's eyes, Madison had a duty, a legal obligation to deliver Marbury his commission. Madison had violated that duty, and when executive officials break the law, courts can step in and offer injured parties like William Marbury a remedy. This judicial pronouncement was a big deal. It wasn't at all clear in 1803 that courts had the authority to issue affirmative orders against the president or his cabinet officials. While Marbury v. Madison is probably more famous today for its discussion of the power of judicial review, which I'll get to in a moment, its insistence that courts can review executive actions and issue orders against the executive may be its biggest contribution to the American constitutional landscape. Having decided that the laws of the country did afford the aggrieved Mr. Marbury a remedy, Chief Justice Marshall then turned to his final question. Is the proper remedy what Marbury asked for, namely a writ of mandamus issued from the U.S. Supreme Court? To this question, you might be surprised to learn Chief Justice Marshall answered no. It is true, Marshall noted, that a writ of mandamus is the proper remedy to issue against an executive official who, like James Madison, had failed to do a non-discretionary act. But the Supreme Court could not issue a writ of mandamus in this case. Why? Because the court found that the statute purporting to grant the Supreme Court jurisdiction over the case was unconstitutional. Recall that Mr. Marbury had filed his case directly in the U.S. Supreme Court, rather than a lower federal court. Federal courts usually don't automatically have jurisdiction over any case that comes their way. In most instances, Congress needs to pass a law giving them jurisdiction over particular classes of cases. When Marbury filed his case, he cited Section 13 of the Judiciary Act of 1789 as the federal statute that gave the U.S. Supreme Court original jurisdiction, that is, non-appellate jurisdiction, over actions for mandamus. The court disagreed with Marbury's jurisdictional theory, concluding that the statute expanded the original jurisdiction of the U.S. Supreme Court beyond what the Constitution specified and permitted. As Marshall explained, Article 3, Section 2, Clause 2 of the Constitution stipulates that the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction in cases involving ambassadors or foreign diplomats, or cases in which a state is a party. Marbury v. Madison fit into none of these categories, so it didn't fit within the Constitution's prescription for the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. Consequently, the provision of the Judiciary Act purporting to give the court original jurisdiction in this kind of a case unconstitutionally expanded the court's original jurisdiction. It was therefore void. So here's the most famous part of Chief Justice Marshall's opinion. Having explained that Congress had attempted to confer original jurisdiction on the Supreme Court, where the Constitution forbade such jurisdiction, Marshall asked whether an act repugnant to the Constitution could nevertheless be the law of the land. The answer, of course, was an emphatic no. The Constitution, Marshall explained, is the supreme law of the land. It organizes the government and assigns powers to each of its branches. If Congress could pass a statute that went beyond the limits of the Constitution, it would effectively be changing the meaning of the Constitution, in which case the Constitution would have no force at all because a body that the Constitution defines and limits could merely override it. It makes sense that the legislature cannot override the Constitution, but notice that it doesn't necessarily follow that it's the court's role to say when the legislature has done so. Marshall, however, took the next step and explained why it was the court's role. Courts have to decide cases before them based on the applicable law. If the applicable law is an unconstitutional statute, the court must decide whether to apply the statute or not. Marshall explained that it would be absurd for courts to apply unconstitutional statutes. Rather, courts have a duty to inquire into the legitimacy of the laws before them, and not to apply them if they're unconstitutional. Indeed, such inquiries get to the very heart of the judicial role. As Marshall famously explained, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. This sentence, defending the court's power of judicial review, that is, court's authority to strike down unconstitutional legislative acts, is one of the most famous sentences in the history of the Supreme Court. It's important to note, though, that Marbury v. Madison did not really create the concept of judicial review. Though the Constitution does not explicitly confer the power of judicial review on the federal judiciary, many scholars today agree that that power was more or less accepted by the time the Supreme Court decided Marbury in 1803. Chief Justice Marshall's opinion is important, then, not for inventing the concept of judicial review, but rather for its defense and elaboration of that authority. Marbury is a canonical case, but we must not lose sight of the questionable nature of Marshall's analysis. Recall, for example, that the court struck down Congress's grant to it of original jurisdiction over cases like Marbury's because the Constitution specifies that the court has original jurisdiction over three categories of cases. But Article 3 doesn't say that those are the only categories in which the court can ever have original jurisdiction. Another reading of Article 3 could be that the Constitution is setting a baseline for the court's original jurisdiction, and that Congress can expand that original jurisdiction if it so chooses. To be clear, Chief Justice Marshall's reading of Article 3 in Marbury is plausible. It may even be the best reading. Still, the issue is tricky, and Chief Justice Marshall's analysis is conclusory, evading some serious legal complications. There's also a very strong argument that the court ought not to have written much of the opinion. Remember that the Supreme Court's ultimate conclusion was that it did not have authority to issue the writ of mandamus because it didn't have jurisdiction, because the statute conferring original jurisdiction upon it was unconstitutional. But if the court lacked jurisdiction, then what was it doing saying all the other stuff it said? Why did it say that Mr. Marbury had a right to the commission at issue, and that courts have the authority to compel governmental officials to carry out non-discretionary duties. Even in the earliest days of the Republic, the court would have been familiar with the notion that courts ought not decide cases if they don't have jurisdiction. Why did Chief Justice Marshall play so fast and loose with this principle? Two reasons strike me as most persuasive. First, this was a way Marshall could get a dig in at Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and the rest of the Republicans. Even if he couldn't actually expect them to follow the court's orders, he could still assert that they had broken the law. Second, Marshall's order of analysis strengthened the judiciary as a whole. In affirming that courts can issue orders against recalcitrant executive officials who neglect their duties, and that they can strike down acts of Congress as unconstitutional, Marshall was signaling that the neglected federal judiciary was a co-equal branch of government. Yet in so doing, the court didn't order anyone to do anything, and in fact, it couldn't have because it ultimately didn't have jurisdiction. I think reasonable people can disagree with Chief Justice Marshall's legal analysis, but as a strategic matter, Marshall gets an A+. Believing that the judiciary was under siege and that Madison would ignore any order against him, the wily Chief Justice found a way to avoid ordering the executive branch to deliver the commission while simultaneously signaling the importance and independence of the federal courts. Fast forward a bit over a decade and a half, and we get to McCulloch v. Maryland, a case that is just as famous as Marbury, and legally speaking, much more important. McCulloch involved the constitutionality of the Bank of the United States. As with Marbury, some background facts are essential to understanding the case. In 1790, not long after the Constitution was ratified, President George Washington's Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, proposed the creation of a national bank. Hamilton argued that a bank could help raise capital in times of emergency, collect taxes, provide loans to the government, and generally assist with the administration of public finances. Congress took Hamilton's suggestion and passed a bill incorporating the National Bank. The bill then went to President George Washington, who had to decide whether to sign it into law or veto it. Before deciding what to do, Washington requested opinions on whether creating the bank would be wise and constitutional. Hamilton, of course, thought it would be both, arguing that the bill was within Congress's implied powers. But Thomas Jefferson, who at the time was Secretary of State, and Edmund Randolph, the Attorney General, both considered the bank unconstitutional. They pointed out that Congress's powers are enumerated in Article I of the Constitution, and that Article I nowhere grants Congress the authority to create a national bank. Washington ended up agreeing with Hamilton and signed the bill into law. The Bank of the United States was moderately successful, but its charter expired in 1811 and was not renewed. The War of 1812 shortly followed. The nation plunged into chaos as key buildings in Washington, D.C. were burned, including the White House and the Capitol. Economic chaos ensued, and there was not enough cash to go around. Partially in response to this new crisis, Congress created a second Bank of the United States in 1816. A short-lived economic boom followed in 1817, but during a financial panic the next year, the bank called in its loans. State banks with loans from the federal bank were badly hurt, and angry states retaliated by imposing various restrictions on the national bank. Some states, including Maryland, attempted to tax the national bank. The federal government didn't believe that state governments had the authority to tax federal entities, so it didn't pay the tax. In 1818, the state of Maryland filed suit against James William McCulloch, the head of the Baltimore branch of the Second Bank of the United States, to recover the unpaid tax. Maryland won its case in the lower state courts, and the case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court on the issue of whether a state government can impose a tax on the Bank of the United States. As in Marbury, Chief Justice John Marshall, once again writing for the full court, broke the case down into sub-questions. The first and crucial question was whether Congress had the power to incorporate the bank in the first place. If Congress lacked such a power, then the bank couldn't exist at all. Chief Justice Marshall's answer was yes, Congress does have the power to create the bank. His reasoning tells us a great deal about both the powers of Congress generally and the way in which the court decides constitutional cases, at least sometimes. It's also strikingly eclectic, drawing on several types of constitutional arguments. First, Marshall made two kinds of historical arguments. One was what might be called a historical practice argument. He noted that Congress had already created the bank a couple of times and the president had signed both bills. The implication was that the court ought to respect the past practices of the other political branches, especially when those branches have undertaken a particular practice on multiple occasions. Marshall's second kind of historical argument might be called quasi-originalist. He noted that it was the first Congress that passed the first bank bill. This Congress was closest in time to the Constitutional Convention and the ratification debates. Those events would have been fresh in the representatives' minds, as they would have been for George Washington, who had presided over the Constitutional Convention and later, as president, signed the bill into law. The implication is that if the Constitution, as it was originally understood, forbade the creation of the bank, then surely Congress and the president wouldn't have created it. Marshall also made various arguments that drew implications from the structure of government as established by the Constitution. One was in response to Maryland's claim that the authority of the Constitution emanates not from the people, but from the sovereign states. Marshall concluded the opposite. The states did not create the national government, he argued, the people did. After all, the Constitution was ratified not by the state legislatures, but by the people, acting in state ratifying conventions. This move was important to Marshall's argument because if the sovereign states did create the federal government, they would have a stronger argument that they could control and tax federal entities. McCulloch v. Maryland thus rejected a robust view of state sovereignty and established the supremacy of federal law. Maryland also claimed that the creation of the bank was illegitimate because the Constitution did not expressly confer on Congress the power to create the bank. Marshall argued that this view misunderstood the very nature of constitutions. Constitutions, he explained, are not like legal codes. They don't provide great detail on how they're to be applied in particular circumstances. Rather, they provide a broad outline for the structure of government. Accordingly, one cannot infer too much from the absence of a provision expressly empowering Congress to create a bank. Marshall also pointed out that an entire section of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, places prohibitions on congressional power. If Congress's powers were truly limited only to those powers expressly conferred in the document, as Maryland had argued, then Article 1, Section 9 would have been entirely unnecessary. Here, Marshall was drawing on a frequent canon of legal interpretation in which we assume that every section of a legal document has some meaning. Unless Congress has some powers beyond those specifically enumerated in the Constitution, there would be no need to include a separate section forbidding Congress from doing certain things. In addition, Marshall made textual arguments in his opinion. He noted that the Articles of Confederation, which the Constitution had replaced, had provided that each state retains powers not expressly delegated to the Congress, suggesting that any power not specifically granted to Congress remained with the states. By contrast, the 10th Amendment to the Constitution deliberately excluded the word expressly, reading, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people." As Marshall explained, the Constitution's framers realized that the Articles had not worked, in part because of the inclusion of the word expressly, which had denied the Confederation Congress the authority to take actions that the country desperately needed. Having experienced the embarrassments resulting from the insertion of this word in the Articles, he explained, The framers of the 10th Amendment made the very conscious decision to omit this word, thus providing Congress more wiggle room than the Confederation Congress had enjoyed.